Gardening can be a real pleasure, but even when you take good care of your plants, nature doesn't always cooperate. When they're stressed, they're less able to fight off pests and disease, and then you as a gardener have to step in. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We have two very knowledgeable and fun guests with us on Garden Talk today. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison in their Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, always wonderful to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Also known as Dr. Death, in
That's
case
right.
we
dun,
refer
dun,
to you. Da, da, da. And Liz Freeman was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of the Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticulture services for her clients. Liz, great to have you back too.
Thank you so much for inviting me back.
It's amazing how much fun disease can be, really.
You have a warped, twisted mind.
No surprise. But no, it's really, it's fascinating topics. And you know, so often we deal with things and we're not quite sure what they are. So that's one of the things we'll definitely talk about is how to tell what you might have. But Brian, weather, not surprisingly, impacts just about every aspect of gardening, including disease. What weather-related diseases are you seeing right now?
Everything under the sun, whether we've had this spring.
I was going to say, whether there's sun or not.
Yeah, there's been a lot of water this year, and so that's really great for diseases of all kinds. So fungal diseases, bacterial diseases, viral diseases, nematode diseases, you talk about it, we've got diseases out there. So.
And Liz, are you seeing similar things?
Absolutely. Lots of symptoms starting to really flourish out there. So it's fun to look at. Lots of pretty designs on leaves and holes and all kinds of fun stuff. Another thing that I noticed with all of the rain is that we've had such phenomenal growth this year that a lot of things are not hardened off. So it looks a little jungly out there, and you touch some of the new growth and it just snaps off because there's just so much water in it.
So hardening off is the process where the plant matures and becomes more sturdy, right?
It is, and it will happen over time, but it's growing so fast that it's not able to do it as quickly as what we've seen in the past. So we do have to be a little careful when you're out there just wading through all of the plants, or else you can get some breakage. It's not going to hurt too much.
We see that too when people over-fertilize, particularly with nitrogen. And so things will grow very, very fast. And again, it tends to be very succulent and very tender.
So let's talk about some of those different families of plant diseases that you ran through quickly, Brian. We'll start alphabetically. Let's start with bacterial. What are some of the common bacterial leaf diseases, especially on veggies maybe?
Yeah, that's primarily where I've been seeing bacterial diseases. So we see bacterial leaf spots on peppers, tomatoes. Angular leaf spot is a bacterial disease that's on cucurbits. And that word angular is kind of descriptive in general. If you see symptoms on leaves, on plants that have very straight edges, so these would be leaf spots. And oftentimes those are bacterial in nature. The bacteria get into the tissue and they get up to a vein and they can't cross the vein, so the vein becomes the edge of the dead area. And then oftentimes in association with those angular leaf spots, we see a little bit of yellowing, a little bit of a halo. So that's oftentimes an indication of a bacterial disease as well. And so we've been seeing lots of problems. The problem with the bacterial diseases on tomatoes, unlike some of the fungal diseases, is that they tend to get on the fruits and blemish the fruits, and so that can be problematic.
And you said cucurbits. What falls under that?
Cucumbers, squash, gourds, pumpkins, anything in that particular
melons
group.
Too?
Melons,
okay.
Yep. Those are all cucurbits.
Okay.
And those lesions, those little spots, get very, very white eventually. So they'll start out very water-soaked, so they'll look kind of wet. And then all of a sudden they'll dry out and they get quite white. So lots of diseases. There's a bacterial canker on tomato and pepper that I've seen also that initially invades the water conducting tissue, but then eventually you get kind of a rotten area along the bottom of the stem and the plant will collapse.
And Liz, you mentioned that you're seeing disease issues with perennials, shrubs, and shorty trees. First of all, what do you mean by shorty trees? I'm getting ready as someone of rather short stature to be offended. But.
Nah, don't be offended. I just have agreements with tree companies that I do 20 feet and under, and they do 20 feet and above. So we call 20 feet and under shorty trees.
Yeah, see, I was going much shorter than 20 feet. So
we like to cohabitate nicely in the industry.
So everybody's got their part of the canopy. Right?
Exactly.
So are you, what types of diseases are you seeing on those shrubs and trees?
You know, almost everything that Brian has talked about, I've seen a little bit of bacterial on some of the fruit trees, and then also on the ornamentals, tons of leaf spot, and I'm hoping I'm wrong, but possibly some downy mildew on impatiens that's starting to rear its ugly head. So we've got a whole host of things.
Am I remembering that downy mildew was a big issue in garden centers? Weren't they not selling?
They had some problems with a supplier who had the disease or had the pathogen, and they distributed plants. And so we saw a real big outbreak. I think it was back around 2011 or 12, one of those two.
I think it started in 11 and then reared its head really bad in 12.
Yeah. And if any, for information, I run a diagnostic clinic, but one of the things we usually charge, but one of the things we will diagnose for free is downy mildew on impatiens.
Okay. So, you'll be getting samples.
Yes. Please send me because we haven't had a sample of that come into the lab yet.
And we hear a lot about powdery mildew, which is more cosmetic, isn't it?
Depends on the plant. Okay. If you get it on cucurbits again, particularly things like pumpkins, it can cause a lot of defoliation. Okay. The tissue will actually brown. But the classic example where it doesn't cause a problem is on lilac. You'll see this white powdery stuff on the leaves, and the lilacs could care less.
Yeah, those leaves are so leathery and tough that it really is just like somebody dipped them in frosting. Cone flowers, when they're improperly planted, those will brown out when they start to get powdery mildew.
I see it on phlox as well.
Monardas
or bee balms are really
problem. Oh, yeah, I think I'm
in terms of woody ornamentals, where I really see problems on some of the nine-bark varieties, Diablo nine-bark, it gets powdery mildew so bad that you'll actually get branch tip dieback from the
I've noticed out in the field that a lot of those that are more in the breeding of the copper color have not been as bad for the powdery mildew, but it could still be early in the breeding development
of
that.
On the red varieties.
Exactly.
And the two mildews, the downy and the powdery, is that fungal? Is that what is
kind
it?
Of.
Or is it
That's a Brian question. I'm going to let him explain.
Technically,
that one.
No. Well, kind of. Powdery mildews are true fungi. There's a whole group of those particular organisms that are quite host specific, but those are true fungi. The downy mildews used to be classified as fungi, but they are genetically distinct from the true fungi, so they've been broken out into their own major group. They're technically called water molds. So those include the downy mildews. If you're ever worried about late blight of potato, that organism is in that group. A lot of our major root rot pathogens are in that particular group as well. So Pythium and Phytophthora are the two that come to mind.
And you mentioned earlier, Brian, that this has been so far a big year for viral problems.
I'm not quite sure for some of them, because what we're picking up are insect-transmitted viruses in areas where there haven't been necessarily a lot of the insects that move them around, particularly, although we've seen a lot of aphid activity, but I'm seeing it in vegetable crops where people usually do a pretty good job in keeping the insects under control. We've seen some tobacco mosaic virus. I actually diagnosed one that was very, very infected. Unfortunately, it was a commercial grower who had an employee who smoked, and you can pick up that virus in tobacco products.
Really?
And that particular virus is touch transmitted, so you can get it on your hands and actually handle plants, and you can infect them that way.
Wow.
And then I've been seeing another one called tomato spotted wilt virus, which is a thrips transmitted virus. It's another little insect. And that one can cause very, very bizarre symptoms on both the leaves and the fruits. Actually, it can cause some tissue death, which is a little bit unusual for a lot of the viruses that are out there.
We are talking with two wonderful guests on Garden Talk today. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. Liz Freemuth was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of the Garden Ho, providing concierge horticulture services. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk. Brandy Funk is our on-air producer, and she is happy to answer your calls when you call in and join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What diseases have you dealt with in your garden? Were you able to get rid of them successfully? Maybe you have a possible disease situation going on right now. Liz and Brian are happy to help. You can also post on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Mueller is M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, you just mentioned, Brian, we do have some calls, and I want to go there shortly, but I'm interested in how these different diseases end up in our gardens. So you mentioned that insects can carry, especially viral ones. What about the bacterial ones? Are those things that hide in the soil? Or?
Some of them actually can be naturally occurring organisms on the surface of plants. So Liz was talking about a disease on cherries. There's a canker disease that one of the variants of that bacterial pathogen can naturally occur on leaf surfaces. It just isn't there in large enough populations to cause a problem. Sometimes they are on weeds and then get either splashed or blown up onto the important plants in our gardens. That, although that's quite frankly, in terms of blowing, is more common with fungal pathogens. They produce spores that can be blown around. Yeah. So there are a variety of ways you can bring them in. Mm-hmm. But there are examples of bacterial diseases that are brought in by insects or pathogens. There are fungal pathogens that can be moved around by insects as well.
And one point that I'd like to make to my clients is that no matter what it is, if you're not cleaning your equipment, you're moving whatever kind of disease it is around your own property.
We spend a lot of time talking about decontamination.
It is so important. I don't think people really understand exactly how important that is.
So, and, well, why don't you give a little how-to on cleaning your equipment?
How-to, very easily. You can just use alcohol, 70% alcohol, and disinfest with that, or 10% bleach solution. And you have to wet it down, soak it, you know, let it dry on the blade so that you're actually killing everything. Now, Brian likes to use fire, but personally...
I'm just shocked. Shocked by that.
We do that a lot in the lab, but we have a fire extinguisher very
Exactly. But you can use even, you know, I go to the dollar store and just make sure that you've got 70% in that product, and you can get a dollar can of disinfectant, and it works just fine. If you're concerned about moving things around, you always have two pieces of equipment that you're using at, you know, alternate times. So one's being disinfected, you're using the other one. And yes, it's time consuming, but it's also expensive and time consuming to take plants out and put new ones in. So it's a minor small thing you can do.
The other thing to keep in mind is that what Liz has been talking about will work really, really well for fungi and bacteria. For viruses, it's
not
a little different.
Not so much.
The bleach and the alcohol don't work as well. And normally what we're talking about there is some sort of very soapy solution. We have some fact sheets actually that have actual recipes of what you can mix up. But usually what you're dealing with is shampoo, sodium lauryl sulfate, which is an active ingredient in shampoo. And then we recommend kind of a lab detergent called Alkanox. And there's a mix of that you can put together. Or you can buy that straight. It's amazing what you can buy on Amazon.com. You can buy the straight sodium lauryl sulfate off of Amazon.com. The problem with that is it's very powdery and it can be a skin and eye irritant. So you have to be a little bit careful.
You probably
if
don't
you're
want to breathe it
that.
In either.
No. So you wear a mask, you wear gloves, you make sure when you're mixing it up. But unfortunately, what you need to do with the viruses is get rid of their protein coat, which they have. And once they're decoded, they don't infect anymore.
All right. We are talking to Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And let's go to the phones. We have Jerry in Shell Lake up first. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thank you. I'm thinking about tomatoes, and a couple years ago I had maybe blight yellow from the bottom up, and I lucked out, got some fruit. Next year I got nothing yellow from the bottom up. This year I said, I moved some 100 feet, moved some 50 feet, and still I'm getting some plants with yellow from the bottom up. One of the guests on the show said blight never goes away. Can you just tell me what to do next?
Probably me.
Yeah, it was probably Brian.
Because it's very difficult. Never is a very extreme word, but those particular diseases are very difficult to get rid of. What you're describing to me, that kind of yellowing from the bottom up, and I suspect if you look closely, you'd see some kind of dead spots or dead areas on the leaves as well, is there are a couple of fungal diseases that cause that. And they tend to survive in little leftover bits of old tomato debris or in, for one of the pathogens, in old potato debris, because one of the fungi goes to both potato and tomato. But it's in that old plant debris that's kind of hanging out. And it's very difficult when you clean up a garden, even if you're very diligent, to get rid of all of that material. And so what you're basically left with is one of the things that you're doing is trying to move your tomatoes around to other areas in your garden. Unfortunately, the spores produced by these fungi can be blown or splashed around. So that doesn't totally take care of the problem. What we normally do is say rotate. Also, increase the spacing between your plants. Best of all possible worlds, I would basically say, when your plants are full grown, your tomatoes, make sure they don't overlap at all in terms of their foliage. What you want to do is promote real rapid leaf drying, because if you keep the leaves wet, the fungi will do really, really well. That's one of the things we've been fighting this year because we've had regular rains. Yeah. And so even if you have the plants spaced far apart, they have been staying wet. Also thin a little bit to get better airflow. When you put your plants in, I would mulch. It doesn't have to be much of a layer of mulch underneath the plants. And also I'd go back where you had tomatoes last year and mulch over that area. You basically want to block spore movement out of those little bits of debris in the soil so that they can't get up into the air. And then whenever you're watering, please, please, please do not overhead water. Do not use a sprinkler. Use a soaker hose. Again, sprinkling is like rain. And if you get the leaves wet, you're going to have more problems. You can get resistant varieties if you look for them. Unfortunately, many of those varieties do not have tomatoes that taste particularly good. And if you're absolutely desperate, and I don't really recommend this for home gardeners, there are fungicides that you can spray. But at that point, I figure it's cheaper and probably more enjoyable to go to the farmer's market and buy tomatoes.
And the only other thing I would add is don't water at night. You know, late in the evening, unless it's so dry, the air is so dry that it's going to dry out. Just want to watch that
a little
bit.
Yeah, if you can get it into the soil, I don't worry too much. Mm-hmm. If you're applying it when dew naturally forms, then I'm not.
Yeah, you can't really do much about that.
You can't do anything anyway. But
don't add to it.
Don't add to it.
Don't add to it.
What I have is people that will water early in the morning, right, as the dew is drying off, and then they sprinkle irrigate. So they just leave those plants wet for a large portion of the day.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to something you said, Brian. So you recommended that Jerry go back and mulch over that initial area where the problem was so the spores don't leave. So is that... That's not hoping to kill what's there because you said it's hard to kill, but it's just trying
a
to keep it contained.
Barrier. Okay. Yep, it's a physical barrier.
Suppression.
Yep.
Okay. So if Jerry wants to plant something else in that original, are there some vegetables that are not susceptible to that might do just fine there?
The only thing I wouldn't replant in that area would be tomatoes and potatoes. Those would be the two that potentially could get the disease. And you could certainly grow corn or peas or beans or any of those other things. But and in general, you want to rotate.
And lettuce is a fairly innocuous plant to rotate with a lot of vegetables. And as long as you're not rotating everything at the same time with lettuce, it's pretty good after tomato.
Does that help, Jerry?
Yeah, it sounds like I have something to work with.
Yeah.
There you go.
And we do have a fact sheet on rotation in the home garden. So, and that's available at our UW Extension Horticulture website, which is...
Is that the Learning Store?
No, it's not the Learning Store.
Oh, okay, not the Learning
Store. It's not the Learning Store. It's Hort. Hort.uwex.edu.
Okay. Hort.uwex.edu. Maybe Brandy can get that up.
And they're also available at my clinic website, too. So I'll plug that. pddc.wis.edu.
And that link definitely is up on the Facebook page. It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Jeff Epping from Olbrich Botanical Gardens joins us. He'll be happy to answer your gardening questions. Happy to answer your gardening questions today are Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. Brian is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. That's part of the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. And Liz is the owner of The Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She was previously a UW Extension horticulturalist? No.
Walworth County horticulturist. Yep.
And we're happy to have both of them with us to answer questions. And one question that we had on Facebook comes with a photo of some pretty sad looking leaves. David in Oak Creek says, first of all, we're proud sustaining members of WPR. So thank you for that, David. And he says, below are photos of the cukes in one of our greenhouses. We've never seen this before. Is it bacterial, fungus? What? We're organic, so we need to know what it is before we take another step. It does seem to be affecting the tasty jade cukes' productivity. And it's, it's brown spots. It looks like it's almost eaten through the leaves in some points.
Yeah, it's a little bit whitish in areas as well, and there's a little bit of a yellow halo. So my first thought is possibly this angular leaf spot that we were talking about. My suggestion would be to get a sample of that into the clinic. And we can take a look at that and diagnose exactly what it is. Because they're quite right. I'm really proud of them for saying we need to know what it is before we do anything. Because that's exactly true. You can waste a lot of time and effort and money treating for things that you're not dealing with if you don't have a good diagnosis.
And put a lot of strong materials into your soil.
Yes, into the environment. Yeah.
Or lose a lot of plants.
Yes, because it won't take care of the problem.
And when they send samples up, Friday is probably not the best day to send them.
Definitely not. Early in the week for mailing. What I would do with this one, since it's a cucurbit, I'm supposed to generate revenue, but I will tell you a secret for this. Tag it as a downy mildew sample on cucurbits, and we do the diagnosis for free.
Whether it turns out to be downy
mildew. We'll give you a diagnosis no matter what. And the same thing applies for if you're sending in a tomato, just tag it as a late blight sample. We do those because we're keeping track of those particular organisms in the state. Particularly late blight is important for us to know about.
All right.
And it's better to be safe.
That's right.
And Brian, I'm sure that people can find the information on submitting a sample at your website.
Yes.
But do you want to just give a quick...
No, that's fine. Okay. I will spend time answering questions and they can check it. And my phone number and contact information is there. If they need to have questions, they can call me.
Great. All right. Well, speaking of answering questions, let's go back to the phones. And Jay in Holman is up next. Hi, Jay.
Hello, Brian. How are you? I have three American chestnuts, and they're spaced a couple hundred feet apart. And I was thinking about pruning them because the lower branches have gained so much weight that I can't mow underneath them and stuff. And I heard that there's an insect that makes some holes in that invites the fungus or the chestnut blight, and so I'm concerned about pruning them at this time of the year. Should I avoid that, and do I have to wait till winter?
Yeah, I would be inclined in general for most trees and shrubs to prune in the wintertime if you can get away with that, because you're exactly right. You want to be very careful about doing that pruning when pathogens, in this particular case a fungus, is active. And also, you're quite right, there can be insect pests that can open up holes in trees that can allow entry for disease-causing organisms. So you're exactly right. I would do that when the trees are dormant, so late November, depending upon where you are in the state. And or, you know, even when we get that lovely little warm period, kind of in January or early February.
Yeah, end of January.
Yeah, where it's like in the 30s. That's, I think, a great time to get out there and do that, because it's warm enough for you to be comfortable, but cold enough that the insects and the disease-causing organisms aren't active.
And it usually doesn't last that long that they get a chance to
get
active.
The leaves and fruit are so heavy that they probably drop down 7-8 feet, and I can't mow under them anymore.
Yeah, I would say if you can hold off doing that into the fall or late fall into the winter, I would suggest doing that.
All right, thanks for that call, Jay. Let's move next to Poinette, and Elizabeth is there. Hi, Elizabeth.
Yes, good morning. I have seem to have a disease problem, kind of unprecedented, in tiger lilies that have been growing on this property for probably 60 years, the Lilium lancifolium, I believe they're called these days.
Okay.
And they're browning from the ground up, and the flower buds are wilting as well. I looked online and saw a picture of something that looked very much like it, and it attributed it to botrytis.
That could be what's going on with the flowers. It's certainly been wet enough for that fungus to be active. That is a relatively weak pathogen, and it tends to go after flowers. We'll see it commonly on actually roses and peonies, and will prevent the buds from opening. So you might be dealing with that. You could also be dealing with root rot issues that are reducing water movement up to the top of the plant, which will cause wilting as well. I have seen that on occasion on lilies. The browning of the leaves could be a water stress issue, but there may also be fungi that are active that infect the leaves that are causing that browning. Again, I can't really say specifically for you. This is one of the things where, again, if you really want to know what's going on, I would send a sample in, and then we can give you a better diagnosis and more specific control recommendations.
And I should add that this year, for probably the first time, we applied some chopped up oak leaves, kind of a fairly thick mulch. Maybe that's the problem. Huh?
Are they around and in the leaves of the daylily of the base?
That's correct.
And with the amount of moisture that we've had this year, I'm guessing that probably would be fantastic in a hot, dry year, but not this year. My guess is it's staying too moist, and you're getting leaf rottage at the base.
I live on a sand and gravel knoll, but I guess this year even we have had plenty of rain.
It's been amazing how much certain places have gotten.
And those oak leaves really hold moisture very, very well, even when they're chopped up. So while the soil may be draining, those chopped up oak leaves are still holding moisture next to those daylily leaves. And my guess is if you rake that off of there, you might see them dry up this next week a little bit, because it's going to be 80 and hot.
On the other hand, you don't want them to get water stressed either.
No,
so it's always that
but
balancing act.
Well, and you know, I look at perennials the same as I do a tree. You're not going to mulch right up to the tissue of that plant.
Okay.
And so when you're looking at mulching around perennials, you want to leave that donut around the base and around the foliage and around the stems, because otherwise the mulch that's supposed to be doing its job of keeping a little bit extra moisture in there is going to be keeping that extra moisture on the stems and the leaves and the other plant parts.
Right.
So just leave a little donut around it and you should be fine. So if you rake it off of the leaves and just leave it around the base, you should be fine.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Let's move next to Diane in Appleton. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a hawthorn that we planted last August that has a maple cottony scale.
Oh.
And we were told to cut it back, and we did pretty severely. In order to eliminate those parts, what chance do you think I have to save the tree?
How infested was this? Was it all over on the branches?
At the ends, primarily.
And you cut off the ends of the branches?
Right.
Okay. How much of the tree is left? First off, how old is it? How big is it? Things like that.
Oh, I would say the trunk is maybe 3-4 inches.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been in the ground?
Since last August.
Just last August. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how was the growth this last year? Did you see some new growth on it?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's where you had the cottony scale?
Primarily, yeah.
Okay. If you cut it back and that isn't my first line of defense for scale. Cottony scale has got a covering over the outside of it that oftentimes applied at the right time, and you have to know the life cycle of the insect, applied at the right time, you might have been able to suffocate that or do a systemic that would have taken care of it. But now that you have cut the branches off, what you need to look at is you need to look as to whether that scale has traveled further toward the trunk of the tree, because oftentimes you won't see those baby crawlers until the shell has actually developed over the top of them and they're feeding. And I actually think this would be a good instance to send a picture to PJ and have him take a look at it. It's not something that we usually see in large amounts on a hawthorn.
And just to clarify, PJ Lee, who's the head of the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Yeah, and I can give out his email address. Do you have a digital camera that you could take some photos?
Sure.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
We looked at the online information from the Wisconsin guide, and it said to cut it back, so that's why we did that.
You're going to be okay. It's just that what happens when you cut back the end of a branch is you're going to get a few years where you're going to have to maintain and retrain the branches, because you're going to get excessive development of new growth. So it's just going to take you a little bit longer. But if you've got all of it and you're fairly confident that it's healthy, it probably will do just fine. You're just going to have to do a little bit of training. But I seriously would send in a picture to PJ, do an up close to make sure you don't have any more scale on there, and then get a recommendation from him as to what to treat with.
Mm-hmm. And again, PJ Leash, it's LIE, I believe.
Right.
LIESCH?
His email address is PLeash, LIESCH, at WISC.edu.
And he's the new head of the Insect Diagnostic Lab, took over from Mr. Phil Pelletieri.
Right. Doing a great job.
Yes, he's on this show quite a bit, and he does do a great job. Well, let's move from Diane in Appleton with her scale to Bill in Deerfield with his potential scale. Hi, Bill.
Oh, boy, we're scaling the height.
Oh, I like that. Very good. Very good.
So I have a magnolia, and it's got a pretty heavy scale in infestation.
Mm-hmm.
And is it too late to use a systemic?
It's actually, no, it's not too late to use a systemic. Did you see the crawlers out? Which
not yet. I've taken a piece of paper and whacked on the branches, and nothing has fallen out yet.
Okay. And actually, you can tell if you go and you peel one of those scale off and take a and you take a magnifying glass and look underneath. Are you seeing a lot of? You should be able to see some babies under there.
Well, okay. I haven't taken the magnifying glass, but I've opened up a half a dozen, and there's generally just one, maybe like a millimeter or even less.
Okay.
Size.
How big is your magnolia?
It's about 6 feet high, but about 12 feet across. It's very umbrella shaped.
Okay. And the trunk diameter?
I'm going to say about 4 inches,
okay.
4.5 inches.
And I think actually...
Well, it breaks out into like three trunks.
So a little bit, those are a little bit smaller. We've had enough moisture that putting a systemic on, if you do it according to directions, you probably will be okay. I worry that you missed the crawler stage on these.
These are late August and September was what we just had a teleconference this morning, and PJ mentioned August and September for crawlers for this particular one.
Because this, for this one, now, do
this
you,
one.
Okay,
magnolia
the magnolia scale.
Yeah.
Do we know which one it is, though? Just magnolia scale? Because I've got a client that has two different kinds of scale.
Yeah.
And we've got one that comes out in June.
Okay.
And one that,
again,
one that comes out later.
Again, this might be a situation to get a sample into PJ for him to look at and verify and then make a recommendation based
on
what he sees.
I think so. But if it is the, and I'm going to go with PJ on this one, if it is the August, then you definitely can get a systemic on there and get it up into the tree. But if you actually wait and watch for the crawlers, a less invasive way to do it is to just wait until you see the crawlers, and you can actually nail them with a good appropriate weighted horticultural oil or a soap even sometimes will work to get them covered and get them suffocated. The crawlers don't have the hard outside shell on them yet, and so if you can get them covered with an oil or a surfactant of some kind that will suffocate them and it'll kill most of them off. That's a less invasive way to do it, but you have to watch. But obviously it sounds like you're having fun playing with these things. So I say continue to have fun.
Well, the thing is, like every year in the past, every year at this time, even earlier, I would tip prune it back, and I noticed that this year it hasn't grown for me to prune it.
Okay, so you're seeing a lot of scale at the ends, then.
Well, all the way in, actually.
All the way in.
Into the branches.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Do you wrap this with lights in the winter?
No, it hasn't been wrapped.
Okay. What I have noticed is that when people do wrap Christmas lights around magnolias and they have beautiful shapes, so oftentimes people do that, you can see an increase in scale because of the warm temperatures that will sort of spur additional development of population. So if you're not doing that, then I would say wait until the crawlers come out, hit them with something. And at that point, you still have time. If you see that there are new scale developing on the branches, you still have time to put a systemic down before fall. And my personal preference would be that you do it that way rather than systemic first and then systemic again and systemic again after that.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Bill. And you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, enjoying the conversation with Brian Huddleston, who's director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, who was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of The Garden Hoe. Stay with us. We are talking viruses and bacterial diseases and all kinds of interesting things that might be showing up in your garden right now with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. They're happy to answer questions about plant diseases and just your general gardening questions as well. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or photo on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go actually to a Facebook question from Lori. She says, I fight fungal diseases, especially powdery mildew, on my plants every year. A friend recommended a fungicide called Serenade, which is bacterial-based, as being more effective than the copper sulfate I usually use. Could your guests comment on how well Serenade works and how the bacteria it contains actually controls the fungi?
I'm not that familiar with Serenade as a product, and oftentimes for foliar diseases, I'm not that big a fan in general of the bacterial products, although it could work. I usually think of those more as seed treatments, quite frankly.
Yeah, okay, instead of on the actually mature plants.
Yeah, although there are some that are formulated as spray treatments, and I recognize that name, but I don't know a lot about the effectiveness of that. Quite frankly, if you're worried about powdery mildews, what I would suggest, there's a little home remedy that's based off some research out of Cornell, which is a combination of baking soda and lightweight horticultural oil that you mix in water, and it's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda and 3 tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil, usually a paraffin-based
oil. Don't use home oil.
You can try kitchen oils, but I would use canola, because the canola, there has been some research that indicates it can have anti-powdery mildew properties, but I always suggest pre-testing that before you apply it to an entire plant. So make up a mixture, apply it to a few leaves, and see if you get burn symptoms, because some of the heavier oils will burn.
Oh, it's just so like putting oil on our skin and then going out in the sun.
Yep, yep, same sort of thing. Oh. And I've had problems with people using dormant oil for this, and that's way too heavy. Some people have used motor oil. That's not a good idea either.
The other thing I would ask is what kind of plants and where are they planted? Because if you continually fight with the same problem in the same area, and I know all of us have those project plants and those project plantings where you really want to try to see if this will work. But if it's not working year after year and you're now applying fungicides and you're looking at developing whatever, I mean, to me, it's just that's overkill. Look at what you're planting. There are a lot of choices out there for you to get the same look and a plant that is not going to suffer from powdery mildew. Hmm.
So or you can look for resistant varieties of
exactly.
a plant that you're interested in. Phlox has been bred for resistance. Sometimes
absolutely.
You can't find the flower color that you want, but it is an option.
Well,
and then spacing is a big thing for powdery mildews. Definitely a lot of spacing between plants because
absolutely.
Powdery mildews love high humidity.
And it really the conditions under which the plants will grow. I push that in my own yard. So if it's a full sun plant, I'll put it in shade to see what happens to it. And I've actually found Peacock series phlox in 75% shade don't get powdery mildew. And so they're fantastic, but they're very difficult to find. And so I can do some of that stuff, but if you have a limited amount of space in your yard, there are plants out there. Please put them in the right conditions. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And the other thing is to kind of get a tolerance for them. Most of the time, powdery mildews are not going to kill your plants. In fact, I don't know of any powdery mildew disease that really kills the plants. On phlox and monardas and the cucurbits, you get some leaf loss, but it doesn't kill the plant. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about something like a lilac, don't bother. The treatments are a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And that's true for most plants. Mm-hmm. I would not treat with a chemical treatment most of the time. Now, if you've got, great Aunt Martha's phlox that she brought over from Hungary in the 1880s that you want to preserve and make sure it looks nice, then you can consider a fungicide treatment. But again, plant spacing is another big thing to consider before you go to the fungicide treatment.
Proper choice, proper spacing. Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and Mary in Menominee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question regarding late blight on tomatoes, and I was wondering, we heard that the copper in hay, so we mulch with hay on the tomatoes. Would it be beneficial if we use copper wire around the edges of the tomatoes?
I would not expect that to help you prevent late blight at all. Certainly, we use copper for treatment, but it's a copper spray that goes on to the leaves, and you need to make those applications before you see any symptoms. And that's quite true of fungicide applications in general. To get maximum benefit, you need to apply them before the disease has started. These are not curative products. They actually prevent the disease from happening. But copper wire, I wouldn't expect to help you with disease control at all.
And Mary said the copper in hay, is that something that...
I don't know that would help either because, again, you need it on the leaf surface and you need a good even coat as well because copper typically is not absorbed into the leaf and moved around internally. You have to have a layer of that protective material on both the upper and lower leaf surface and on branches as well.
And copper really can inhibit the root growth also. So you don't want to get it right in the ground
soil.
next to the roots too.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. Let's go back to the phones and Lenore in Plover. Hi, Lenore.
Hi. Actually, I'm calling about the hydrangea question, but I have been using the baking soda, mm-hmm. and also mm-hmm. people might want to know that if they spray it on their broccoli and cauliflower, that those white butterflies won't lay those worms.
There you go. That's a nice use.
Yeah. Yeah, it works great. But anyway, my question is, I'm in a store, sorry about that. My question is, on my hydrangeas, and I have great hydrangeas, but in the spring, there's some bug or spider that keeps wanting to put my leaves to, put my leaves together, mm-hmm. and I go in and I pull the leaf apart gently and squash the little worm that's in there. But what is it, and what can I do about it?
It's a leaf roller, but I don't know which one is specific to hydrangeas. Yeah, they do go away after a little while, correct?
Oh, no, I mean my...
Do you get them all season?
Yes. Well, no, by now they are not. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I am in there every day, and I say, yesterday I did it, and there's 15 more. And I have a friend who doesn't take their leaves off and do that, and it literally killed her hydrangeas. Mm. So we were both kind of wondering, what the heck can we do?
It's a leaf roller, and I don't know which one it is. And without knowing which one it is, I don't know what to do for a treatment. So my suggestion is, if you can get a sample to the lab, the insect diagnostic lab, I would say have them take a look at it and tell you exactly which one. More than likely, there's going to be a relatively innocuous spray or systemic treatment that you can use that will keep them off of there. But without actually seeing it, I would not be comfortable giving you a recommendation.
You're in Plover, correct?
Yeah, so what kind of innocuous maybe spray would it be? Possibly.
Yeah. Yeah, what I would suggest you do, you could actually take a sample of those insects, just put them in a jar and take them up to the county extension office that's in Stevens Point and talk this summer, at least, if you're still seeing them. Walt Rasmussen is the summer help for horticulture up there. He could take a look, and then if he can't identify what they are, he could get the sample down to Madison, to PJ, to take a look at.
Because I actually find a little yellow worm in there, but mm-hmm. I know that that's probably not what's doing, and I think that's maybe been planted there or something.
Well, I would certainly
bring that along and see
what that actually is, because that could be what's causing your problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lenore. Take care. And on the Facebook page, Alan says, I have several tomato plants in my garden. Some have perfect leaf development. Others are poorly developed with leaf curl. Any ideas what I may try to improve tomato plant health?
Yeah, this looks like...
And there's a picture that it kind of looks like some...
It's very bizarre.
Pretty. It's very pretty.
Mm-hmm. My thought, given that the caller said, or the person who emailed you has plants that are kind of scattered, mm-hmm. is that it's probably viral in nature. It could be herbicide, but usually I would expect all of the tomatoes to be affected.
And with that amount of curl, I'd expect to see some browning by now, too. Yeah.
With an herbicide. But I'm suspecting a virus of some kind. If they happen to smoke, it could be tobacco mosaic. The other very common one that we can get if you've had a lot of aphids is cucumber mosaic virus. But there are just oodles and oodles of viruses that go to tomatoes. We had a sample come in one year where we did $350 of testing for all kinds of different viruses, and not that they paid for it. We mm-hmm. were curious, so we did it ourselves. And we were never able to specifically identify the virus, and all we could find, somebody did some electron microscopy on it, said, yes, there's a virus particle there, and that's all the farther we were able to mm-hmm. go. None of the ones that there's a great lab in Elkhart, Indiana that tests for viruses, all of their tests were negative. And so we knew we had a virus, but couldn't figure out which one. Mm-hmm. But again, if they wanted to send it a sample, and I know it's not late blight, but they can say, I'm scared that it's late blight, and we'll test it for viruses, and we'll do it for free.
All right. Well, Alan on Facebook, that's the way to go. Let's go back to the phones and Julie in Eau Claire. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My hollyhocks, I've got quite a few in the garden and kind of in a bed. All the leaves got that orange nodules on it. I mean, they're blooming, but it doesn't look very nice. And is there anything I can do about that? Even all the little, there's dozens of little tiny plants coming up below from seed, and they're all covered with orange nodules. And then the second quick question, what is your opinion on triassicide? I always have grasshoppers.
Yeah, I won't be able to answer the insect question, unfortunately. That's just, I know enough to be dangerous about insects, and I know absolutely nothing about insecticides, so I will pass on that particular question. But in terms of the hollyhock one, that one I know what it is. It's a disease called hollyhock rust, and those little bumps that you're seeing are masses of fungal spores, and I've seen really spectacular cases of that this year. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to manage, because it's going to survive in old plant debris. And again, once those plants die back, as diligent as you are to try to clean up those old plant materials, you're not going to be able to get everything. So the fungus is going to hang out in those little bits of old plant in the soil. And then it will produce spores next year that will reinfect any hollyhocks that come up in the vicinity of where you've had the problem this year. One thing you could try would be to start with new seed and go to a different location in your yard. I won't guarantee that that'll totally take care of the problem, because the spores can, of course, blow around. Also, make sure you've got good spacing so they're not crowded. And again, what you want to do is make sure if the leaves get wet, they get dry very, very quickly. The longer they stay wet, the more likely you're going to get an infection. And then there are some of the other mallows that kind of look like hollyhocks, mm-hmm. but aren't as susceptible. So certainly there are some of those. I can't give you specific varieties. We do have a fact sheet on this particular disease where I believe we list some of the different species that you could try, but it's a difficult one to deal with. And the problem, I think there has been some breeding for resistance, but there are several variants of this particular pathogen. And unfortunately, the variant that you have can change from year to year. And so if you plant something that's resistant one year, it may not be the next.
Mm-hmm. I'll weigh in on the triazicide. Yeah. I have to ask you, what do you want to control? How grasshoppers, where are they horrible? Are they living in your yard?
Well, I don't have them yet, though I'm seeing them. But the last few years, just... And they eat all the flowers as they're coming, like gladiolas, dahlias, mm-hmm. just terrible mm-hmm. to have them. I'm out in the country.
Yeah, as long as, check the label, and as long as it's labeled for grasshopper control, triazicide is actually quite effective. You will kill everything with it, though, so that's beneficials and non-beneficials alike. It's not a discriminating insecticide, but it is effective. I would just be a little cautious in what you know, how you apply it. But if you're applying it to the plant, you should actually get some fairly good residual with it. And check the label. Read the label very, very carefully so that you know that your critter is on there, and also that it can be applied to ornamental plants, because there are different formulations that can be applied to different plant types. So just make sure that you check that. Read the label very, very carefully.
Okay.
And the writing's very small, so get your magnifying glass out.
Yeah. I always do read the labels.
Good for you.
Good.
Excellent for you.
My concern is bees, and it doesn't mention bees.
No, it will, but it's an indiscriminate insecticide, so it will take bees out also.
I think
I don't want to use it.
Yeah, what I would suggest you do, you're in Eau Claire County, so I would give the county extension office a call, then talk to Erin Lefebvre. She's the horticulture educator in Eau Claire County. Talk over the problem that you're seeing. She may not directly have an answer to give to you, but again, she can contact someone like PJ down in Madison, get advice on what you might use that would be more targeted towards the insect that you want to control. Because certainly you don't want to be taking out your pollinators.
Mm-mm. Yeah, definitely not.
All right, let's go back to the phones and Jeremy in Mayville. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have an oak tree, and I'm not 100% sure what kind of oak tree it is. It's got the rounded leaves, and like instead of the regular oak acorns, they're kind of spiky.
Mm-hmm.
But the leaves are like wilting. Like the veins of the leaves are there, but like the outside of the leaves are either being eaten or
okay.
I don't know, there's some.
Where are you seeing the wilting? Is it on every single leaf, or is it in a particular area of the tree?
It's like 80% of the tree.
Okay, and you're seeing the veins are still there, but the tissue in between the veins is starting to dry up or wilt?
Yeah, wilt. Or, okay. Like I said, it's either being eaten, you know, it's like eaten out, like circularly.
Okay, Jeremy, your sound quality is not great because I think you're in a car. So let's get a quick response from Brian and Liz.
Yeah, that would be something where I would suggest get some of the leaves and send them in for us to take a look at, because I can think of several things that it could be, and we're going to need to take a look at the leaf tissue. And there could be some fungal diseases. It could be tatters, which is a physiological problem.
Could be insect eating.
Could be insect eating, and we need to take a look at those leaves. From what you're saying, I don't think it's oak wilt, which would be the really major one that we would need to worry about. But at this point, if you're willing, it would be a $20 fee to do this, but send it in. And quite frankly, if it's insect, it's no charge at all.
All right. Good luck with that, Jeremy. Jennifer on Facebook asked, and I think this is kind of going back to, you know, the general kind of garden hygiene. In our battle against fungus, does it help to burn vegetable garden debris at the end of the season?
Yes.
And it's very satisfying.
Yes. It is, you know, not necessarily as environmentally friendly in terms of air pollution, but from a disease control standpoint, if you incinerate that material, burn it really well, that's a way of getting rid of disease-causing organisms.
Yeah. And is that just for fungus, or is that for any of the others that you talked about as well?
In general, it would be good. Some of the viruses, I would worry about if you didn't totally burn the material, them getting airborne. But I think for fungi and bacteria, it would work quite well.
And if burning is not an option, because for a lot of people it's not, what are the best ways to contain and get rid of potentially diseased material?
The appropriate way, and I believe it is still appropriate, is you can double bag and put it into trash pickup. That's about the only thing that you can do that's legitimate to put into trash when it's green material. You don't want to put it in a compost site. Definitely not. Not unless it's a hot one. Yeah, I mean,
depends,
you can compost
depends
yourself.
Depends on what it is, but if you do really good composting, you have to heat up the pile.
And you have to monitor that heat. And that can get very tough, because if you don't turn it and do it on a regular basis and watch that temperature, you're going to allow those things to escape. So if you're unsure of how to deal with it, you can't burn. Double bag into the trash. Not everything, just the diseased material.
Just the diseased material, because you're not supposed to get rid of organic matter like that in the trash. We are talking with Brian Huddleston. He is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, part of the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and now the owner of The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Brandy Funk, our on-air producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A lot of us really love getting out and getting our hands dirty in the garden. Some plants seem to grow well no matter what, while others are really susceptible to pests and disease. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk. Our guests today have lots of great advice for a healthy and happy garden. Liz Freemuth was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge services for her horticulture clients. Liz, thanks for coming back today.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation.
It's always a lot of fun.
It is a blast.
And Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, Dr. Death, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me again. It's been a great year this year, let me tell you.
Well, it's
I'm a happy camper, let me tell you.
Well, it's nice that, you know, bad years for other people are good years for someone else, right? Well, we are talking a lot about plant disease, and boy, we've had a lot of calls and emails and Facebook posts, but also covering some general garden questions as well. And actually, before we go back to the phones, I just want to sneak this quick one in, because it's always kind of fun to talk about. Sue from Pulaski called, and she had a question. She has potato foliage that's producing something that looks like little green tomatoes, and she wonders what in the world that is.
Those are the fruits. It's normal.
Yeah, it's
it
potato
happens.
Fruit, right?
Right, that's right. It happens.
Don't eat them.
But don't freak out about them.
Okay. See, once in a while, you can tell people, nothing to worry about.
Now, if they start to form tubers on the branches, then we have a disease problem.
So there's actually
a little phytoplasma disease. It's a variation on something called aster yellows that will induce the plants to start to produce little tiny tubers on the branches.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
And I look at those things as a reason to grab a cocktail of choice, alcoholic or none, and invite the neighbors over and go and look at it. Because why not?
Yeah, I'm sure that's quite a successful pickup line. Want to see my potato first?
Yeah. Only in the gardening world would you get a yes.
Yeah, and probably several. Yep. Right? Well, let's go back to the phones and Lois in Eau Claire. Hi, Lois.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had to treat 3 peony plants for white powdery mildew last year using the copper-based thing. And then in the fall, as I was instructed, I cut them down. I waited till probably the end of September, cut them down to the ground, cleaned up the area. The 3 came up well this year, but only 2 out of the 3 had blooms. And then those were only 3-4 on each bush. So, did I cut it down too soon?
No.
Okay.
How long have they been in the ground? Are they old ones?
They're old ones, but I had transferred them from another garden, but they've been in my spot here in Eau Claire for about 6 years.
Did they start to die out in the center at all?
No.
Okay, so they didn't look like they were ready for dividing again?
No.
Okay. It may have been that whatever infected your peony actually did move down into the roots a little bit. Unusual for a powdery mildew
to do
that.
Yeah, I would expect a powdery mildew to do that. Are they in the shade?
You know, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, because when you said you had powdery mildew, usually I see that on plants that get a fair amount of shade,
and
that's
peonies
not great
especially.
for flowering either.
Yeah, I would move them.
Because it's probably 50-50 and getting more shade.
Yes.
Yeah, and actually September, you can wait until that long, but you can actually start cutting your peonies back in August, the middle of August, and moving them in the middle of August.
Okay.
August 17th is what the grower told me. That's magic date. You can start playing with your peonies on August 17th. So if it was really, really wet and those stems actually started to decompose a little bit if you waited too long, but usually September, November, we're still fine. I don't worry about disease getting into them until December. Yeah. I would move them into full sun. If you have a spot where you like the way a peony looks, try a tree peony instead of an herbaceous peony. They will tolerate shade a little bit better, and you won't have issues with powdery mildew. So, again, if it's a spot, you can find a plant that will work. But I would move that one right now.
And I think that'll help with your powdery mildew problems, too.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Absolutely.
All right. And the powdery mildew I had on the squash, I sprayed that, cleaned it, pulled them out, cleaned it all, and my vegetable garden has been fine so far this year.
Excellent.
So it was just the peonies that I still had a question about.
Excellent.
So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck. August 17th.
There you go.
Right,
mark your calendar. I think that's a Monday, if I'm remembering right. Thanks, Lois.
On a Monday.
Thanks, Lois. Let's go back to the phones, and Susie is calling from a place that many people wish they were, I bet, right about now, Madeline Island.
Oh, yes.
Lovely part of Wisconsin. Hi,
too.
Susie.
Very much.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I have a North Star cherry, which is planted on the lakeside, and for 2 years in a row, the tips of the branches, the leaves have all turned brown on them, and also a lot of the fruit has also kind of turned brown and almost looks like it has a mold growing on it.
Okay, is it you seeing the branch die back across most of the tree, or is it localized?
A lot of it. I sent you on email pictures of what the branches look like.
Yeah, we weren't able to get those up, but the
majority of the branch is green leaves. It's just the tips that are browning off on many of the branches.
Yeah, there could be a couple things. And you said your fruits are kind of shrunken and look kind of fuzzy, kind of buff colored.
In a very heavy clay soil.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, there's a couple things that could be going on. We've seen a lot of fruit trees, including cherries, because of the really harsh winter of 2013-14 that had just a lot of general branch dieback. And we've continued to see that occur this summer as well. So in part, it could be stress from that really bad winter and your trees are just continuing to show the problems. The other thing that could be going on when you've got those buff-colored, mummified fruits, you probably have a disease called brown rot. And that particular fungus is it likes to colonize the fruits and cause them to mummify, but it can also move on to the branches and cause some branch tip dieback. So what you probably want to do is this winter is go in and where you've had those dead tips would be to prune them back. And then probably about 4 inches below where you see where you've seen the dead tissue, and just clean that up. That will hopefully take care of at least some of the brown rot. The other thing you have to be very careful to do, though, is to collect up any of those mummified fruits mm-hmm. that have fallen on the ground, because that fungus will survive there. It produces a little mushroom-like structure in the spring, and that will start the cycle all over again. So good cleanup of those old infected fruit is very, very important to get brown rot under control. If you're hooked up to the internet, we do have a fact sheet that's available on this particular disease that talks about what I've been speaking of. But I think at least some of your problem is probably environmental. It's probably mm-hmm. carryover stress from that horrible winter we had in 2013.
And going back to your comments earlier, Liz, about good hygiene when you're using mm-hmm. tools, in a case like this, should you be wiping or sterilizing in between each cut, or?
Best of all possible worlds, yes. Okay. Yeah. I know a lot of people that takes a lot of time, but if you're willing to do that, I think that's the best way to get control. Usually what I tell folks is that if they're really, really desperate and can't do between every cut is every few cuts do it, at worst between trees, definitely, because mm-hmm. you don't want to spread stuff sure. from tree to tree.
Yeah, and you know, if you're going down into healthy tissue, that's better than if you're cutting through something that's diseased and not cleaning.
But you never
in between
quite know if it
exactly.
is really healthy.
Right.
That's
exactly.
the thing.
And especially because these things, a lot of them are airborne, that you mm-hmm. don't know where they land. So it may look like you're okay, but right. it's not necessarily okay.
Right. Yeah. And people oftentimes ask about pruning paints. We do not mm-hmm. recommend pruning mm-hmm. paints in general. The only time we recommend using pruning paints is if you have an oak tree that you were forced to prune during the growing season. Mm-hmm. Then you want to have that can of paint. And it doesn't have to be pruning paint. You can take some old latex paint.
Really?
Yeah. White, yeah.
Yep,
yeah.
And just immediately paint over that wound. Do not wait. What you're trying to do is prevent insects from visiting that wound on the oak tree that can bring in the oak wilt fungus. And it's just a physical barrier. That's mm-hmm. why you don't have to have special pruning paint. Mm-hmm. And you have to do it immediately because there's some documentation that those insects can visit within 10 minutes of you cutting.
Oh,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
And you can add a little color to the garden.
Yes, mm-hmm. indeed.
It can match your bedroom walls. Well, good luck with that, Susie. Do you have what you need to move forward on that?
Right, I think so. The question about the pruning in the winter when you've got the dormancy, you still mm-hmm. need to clean the shears?
Yeah, I yes. would be inclined to do yes. that still then, yes. yeah. I know it's a hassle, but you'll be happier, I think, that mm-hmm. way, and so will your tree.
Safer, yeah.
All right, well, hopefully we won't have to call you back next year.
All right. That's the spirit, Susie. Thanks so much for calling. On Facebook, Tom posted a photo. He says, I'm wondering if you can identify the issue with our autumn moon maple. And it looks like it's prematurely turning a little red, and there are some kind of dark purplish blotches on it. What do you think, Brian?
Well, Liz and I were talking about the purpling. We think that mm-hmm. could be normal for the tree.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
But the blotches, I think, are probably, I can't tell exactly, but I think it's probably anthracnose, which is a fungal disease that we see on maples. It doesn't look particularly severe. Main way to deal with that is good fall cleanup okay. and remove those leaves and get them out of your yard.
Okay.
And normally not fatal.
No, not at all.
Okay. More cosmetic than
yes.
anything.
Exactly. And the rest of the picture, for those of you who can't see what we're seeing, the leaves look very, very,
very good
yeah. behind.
Yeah,
nice, good color, not a lot of spotting. It's just in that one particular area. And if it's new growth, that can be a little bit tender. And if it just managed to get some pathogens on it, there you go.
Right.
And so hopefully the rest of it will be okay.
All right. Good luck with that, Tom. Let's go back to the phones and Kel in Sugar Camp. Hi, Kel.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a very, very large tub that I grow tomatoes in for my mom at her house. And this is the third year I use the same soil, and the tomatoes are just no good. They're yellowing from the bottom up. So I obviously have concentrated some of the tomato funguses into the soil. I know that you're supposed to change the soil every year, but we're talking about a lot. So I'm wondering if any way I can have this soil and just maybe alternate two batches of soil. I was wondering if I can bake this stuff like on a piece of plastic on a black top driveway in the sun, you know, really like a half inch deep or something, or if I can compost the soil and kill everything in it and reuse it. Even if I can't use it for tomatoes, can I reuse it for anything else?
Yeah, you get Brian's nodding because he wants to jump in here. Go ahead, Brian.
No, no go ahead, Liz.
And disease-wise, how did everything look up to this point throughout the years? How have they been doing?
The very first year was, they were fabulous. It was all bagged soil like shelves. And so I just, you know, and then that last year was pretty good, but I had a little bit of yellowing. I was, uh-oh. You know, I kept picking off the bad leaves. I just kept picking them off. I had fairly good fruit. This year, they're just hardly growing. They've got fruit and flowers, but they're abysmal. And the yellowing is just catching up to the fruit and flowers.
Have you been fertilizing?
Just a little bit. I use time-release pellets. I don't put a lot in there.
Okay. That may actually have something to do with some of the reduction in health of your plants. If you've not had major diseases in it, actually solarizing, depending on how deep they are, you can put black plastic over the container and heat it up, but then you're going to have to turn it, almost like you do in a compost bin, where you heat it up and get a compost thermometer that's going to measure what the temperature is. It looks like a very long meat thermometer, and that will tell you where you're at. And you want between 140 and 160 to kill things in there. So if you're looking at killing pathogens, weed seeds, etc., you need to get that up. But then you have to turn the soil over. So you get a shovel or a fork and get it turned over, put the plastic, you know, keep that on, allow it to heat up, and continue to do that. The problem with solarizing is that you are removing all bacteria out of the soil, so beneficial and non-beneficial. So that means you're going to have to introduce some stuff back in, which kind of defeats the purpose of killing weed seeds, because if you're going to put compost in, you're probably going to get some weed seeds and some, and you might get something else in.
I don't care about weed seeds. I'm only trying to kill the tomato virus and funguses. Yeah.
Well, and I'm not so sure you have one in there.
Yeah, and I don't know how well solarization will work here, particularly this summer when it's been so rainy and cloudy. We don't get enough.
Well, we're getting hot. If we get hot and dry, we'll be fine.
Oftentimes here in Wisconsin, we don't get enough continual days of heat to get it up and continuously hot for long enough.
Brian and I are going to disagree on this one, because we do that in some instances. Okay. But you have to be really, really diligent about it, and it's not something you can do half-heartedly. You actually have to seriously work at doing this. And so if you're going to do something like that, or you're going to put it out on the driveway and cover it with black plastic, that can work too. But again, only when it's really, really hot, as Brian said.
I think your better option would be to use that soil, which is one of the things you suggested for growing other kinds of plants, because then you could rejuvenate the soil in your big tub and grow your tomatoes, and then use that soil, old soil, for growing other vegetables or ornamentals or whatever.
But no matter what you do, you're going to have to put some fertility back in, because tomatoes are heavy feeders, and you are going, no matter what you put in there, it's going to feed as well. We'll feed oftentimes in a different matter, but it's going to feed. And so you do have to put some fertility back in, definitely.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kel. And speaking of fertility, how do you tell? Because sometimes fertility issues can look like disease issues, right?
Correct.
How do you tell the difference?
You actually send a soil sample up and have it.
A tissue sample.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, seriously, we say it kind of in jest, but that's what we all do is, you know, yes, you can kind of see that something's going on, but unless you have it in front of you and it's been lab tested, you don't know for sure what you're dealing with.
Yeah, and the thing is, you may be able to look at it and say, yeah, that looks like a fertility issue, but 9 times out of 10s, you're not going to be able to tell exactly which nutrient is the problem. That's why you get the test. And you want to target your fertility regime to the nutrients that you need in your soil.
Mm-hmm. All right. And speaking of soil, Jean on Facebook asked, how do you dispose of used potting soil? I added compost and a little new potting soil to last year's soil, but I ended up with more than I need. Our recycling center doesn't want it with garden waste, and I don't want to send it to the landfill.
Really, potting soil, if you've got a yard with a lawn, you can use it. Just sprinkle it over the grass if you've got a low spot. It's fine. You can
check
put
with
it
your neighbors.
Anywhere.
They might need. Yeah. Love to have some potting mix.
Exactly. But I will. I just dump it outside and use it around my plants as well. It works fine as long as you don't have disease issues.
Yeah.
That
or what
you're
about
sharing.
Outdoor container gardening?
Absolutely.
Too,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
It
any
up.
Of it.
Certainly.
Yeah. Any
especially
of it.
With that compost she had.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Let's go back to the phones, and we have Jan in La Crosse. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call, or good afternoon.
Sure.
My question is about tomatoes. I have an above-ground container. It's made out of cedar wood, and I have three tomato plants in there. Two of them are grape tomatoes. They're doing great. The tomatoes are tasting delicious. The third one is the one I'm having a problem with. It's Roma tomatoes. They, tomatoes are growing what looks like beautifully, and they're well-shaped. And then all of a sudden, while they're still green, the bottom of the tomato turns totally brown. So they look like they're rotting from the bottom up.
Yeah. Speak of a fertility issue. We were just speaking of soil fertility, and this is actually not a true disease. It's actually a nutrient deficiency in the plant. And you selected the best variety probably to have this problem. Romas, I see a lot of problems. It's called blossom end rot. And it's actually a calcium deficiency in the plants. And we tend to see this when there might not be enough calcium in the soil. Sometimes we do have enough calcium, but there's not enough water, or you unevenly water your plants, and so they're not able to take up a lot of calcium and get that into the fruits. But the Romas are particularly susceptible. So I usually recommend more even watering, more water, particularly when they start to flower and fruit. And then if you continue to see the problem, you may want to do a soil test to see whether you need calcium. I'd be a little bit shocked with our soils whether
that would be the case. Yep.
So it's more that it's there, but it's not getting distributed.
Yeah, you can't get it up, taken up into the plant. So we oftentimes see this when we have really hot, dry summers.
And so if Jan has fruits that already are showing blossom end rot, do you leave those fruits on the plants? Do you take them off so they can start on a new fruit?
Take them off and dispose of them. Okay. Do not eat them. They're considered adulterated at this point.
And don't make the plant bring it to ripeness when you're not going to use it anyway. Okay. All right. Thanks for that, Jan. And yeah, that's a pretty common. It looks horrible.
It's so sad.
Actually, we had Jeremy on Facebook said, I've seen videos of crushing antacids in water and spraying on tomato plants to treat blossom end rots. Do you have a comment?
There are some calcium treatments that you can do. I know that those exist. I don't think that's the best way to deliver calcium. I think taking care of it in the soil and the good watering is probably a better way. But I do know there are calcium sprays.
It seems like kind of an expensive way to get calcium into the soil when generally we do have enough calcium in our soil.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. It's about when you water, how much you water, and how much the plant needs.
Right.
Yep.
Tessa in Bayfield emailed and asked, my normally gorgeous, healthy zinnias are suddenly dying off, wilting, turning light brown, and keeling over at ground level. Also, some pea vines have yellowed, and the Jacinto kale is yellowing and looking awful, but not the curly kale. Lots of rain up here in Bayfield and warmth. Any thoughts? Any help?
Root rots would be the first if you've had a lot of, and given the variety of things that are going on. Some of it could be, if it's just yellowing, it could be leaching of nutrients. But if they're collapsing and falling over, it makes me think root rots of some kind.
Definitely. And zinnias have had a really tough time this year, given the weather that we've had. They don't like this. They like hot and
dryish.
Yeah. The kale, that one kind of surprises me a little bit. So I'm leaning with Brian on root rot on this one, because this is sort of the weather that kale likes. And especially that particular kale. It actually will do well with this.
One thing I would look for would be on the leaves, if you're seeing browning, does it look very, very angular? So it looks like it's vein delimited. Is the browning have kind of a yellow halo that kind of follows the main vein down the leaf? There is a bacterial disease that we get on anything in the brassica group. So cabbages, kales, broccoli, cauliflower, anything of that sort. And that one has been a problem for several years now. It's called black rot. And again, we do have a fact sheet on that. That organism usually survives in debris in the soil. You usually introduce it initially on contaminated seed.
The other thing I do see with the elongated leaf kale is they are very sensitive to water deficits.
Okay.
And so you can actually, you know, if it isn't the angular and it isn't that it's a root rot, potentially it could be that there was just a deficit of water at one time and those leaves will turn yellow. There won't be any spotting on them. They'll just turn yellow. Pick it off and move on, because they'll regrow.
All right. And just a final note, following up on the woman who has grasshopper problems. We had a caller from Wisconsin Dells who says grasshopper problems can be solved by cats, and a Facebook and a Facebook fan who says chickens.
I was going to say chickens come to mind.
There you go.
Well, as always, Brian and Liz, thanks so much for a fun and informative program.
Our pleasure.
Oh, love it. Love it.
Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Liz Freemuth, the owner of the Garden Hoe. Well, next time on Garden Talk, it's Jeff Epping from Old Brick Botanical Gardens. And Monday at 11, we'll talk with Wisconsin actor James DeVita about his new murder mystery. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Garden Talk.